going. I will kick it over to you guys to give a brief introduction, and then we'll get rolling.
Hi, I'm Tyler, one of Clay's childhood friends, currently in Wisconsin serving as a focus missionary. So what I do is like work with collegiate outreach and just like walk with students in their desire to pursue a faith. That's what I currently do. I was born and raised Catholic all of my life. And Clay's kind of asked me today to step on with my friend Matt to talk about a little bit about Catholicism. So,
I'm Matt Lichtinger. I currently live in Seattle and I work in cybersecurity at Microsoft. And I'm visiting Tyler today in Wisconsin for the weekend. And so I get the joy of hopping onto this podcast a little unexpectedly, but I'm excited. I was also born and raised Catholic, and that environment is actually where Tyler and I met each other and grew really close together. So I think it's a cool opportunity to be here to chat about it today.
So where are you guys at right now? I like the background in here.
Yeah, so we're in like the living room of the rectory, which I live in. So I live with my teammate, Evan, who is like on my focused like missionary team. And then we have two students who live with us, and then a young adult guy, and then Father Zach, who's our chaplain for the Newman Center, which is on campus. So the six of us all live together. And this is like the house that is attached to St. Mary's Church, which is one of the three churches in Oshkosh.
So what, you're at a university, right? Is it?
Yeah. University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh. So it's one of the like 12 UW school system universities. Okay.
So how was it, how did you get into college ministry? Like, and how's it going?
It was just something that I encountered when I went to Cincinnati. So I went to University of Cincinnati for my undergrad, and basically the first probably 5 weeks that I was there, I didn't really like know what was going on, but I still kind of figured that I was like supposed to go to Mass. I feel like there's like the weird bridge where it's like you leave for college and then you don't have your parents like telling you what to do. And so it's like, oh, actually, what do I want to do? And so I think I still felt like this attachment to, it was like the right thing to do, that if I like just kept going to Mass, like that's what I've been used to. And so I was doing that. And it was like one of the Sundays, one of the missionaries there approached me and asked me like what my name was, and like just like tried to like get to know me. And we ended up like going out for lunch, and he kind of introduced me to like what focus was, but I was like not really accustomed to it all until like my senior year, where I started to get more involved within the Newman Center on campus, and basically was going through what they call like discipleship, which is the more intensive kind of just like one-on-one time spent with like the missionary, where you're like talking about just a host of different things, mostly related to like college life. So a lot of things they focus on, like the big three, which is like chastity, sobriety, and excellency, and just the ways in which like those vices can be challenged in college. And so just like in working with that, Tim at the time asked me if I wanted to apply for staff, and I like said no. I didn't think it was something that like, I really wanted to do, but as I was like praying with it more, it seemed like this was like an opportunity like to give up myself in a way that like I don't think I really had experienced like doing that before. And so was planning on doing teaching once I finished my student teaching at the school that I was working at, Cincinnati. But then eventually I started to feel this call. So in the spring, they gave me an offer, and that sent me out to Denver, Colorado for a year. And then now it's like placed me in Wisconsin.
So I hear you keep saying Newman. Is that in reference to what, Cardinal Newman, like John Henry Newman? That's really interesting. Newman. You know, I was telling you about that, that series on HBO, The New Pope, all that.
Yes, the show.
It's I don't know how a Catholic would I don't know how they would feel about watching that series. It's pretty interesting. I thought it did a decent job of talking about some of the hot topics in Catholicism, and just and being still entertaining enough for somebody that's outside of the church to engage with it. But in that second season, they go and recruit like the new Pope, and he's English, and Cardinal Newman is his like spiritual father, basically. So it's pretty interesting. Yeah. Okay. And then it's interesting too that you said the sobriety thing. Is that related to his school of thought?
That I know of. Basically the Newman Center is like even like outside focus. It's mostly a thing that is like funded by like the local church that's within the city that the university is by. And it's like, it's meant to be basically just like a building either on or near campus that students are able to like, just like come to. So in a way it feels like almost like a religious safe house, what you'd call it on campus. But like in actuality, it's just like a place where a lot of students come for like community events. And there's normally a ton of rooms where like you either have like, like religion classes. Like if it's like younger children are also like within the parish, or if it's just like more of like a college town, then it tends to be like just a place like where people will just like host different community events together like throughout the university.
Yeah, and they also sometimes will blend that into like young adult programs as well. So at Michigan, where I went to school, they had really powerful young adult programs too, because when you have those like graduate students that are sometimes up in their late 20s or sometimes even early 30s, you know, they don't really have that opportunity to sort of coalesce and bond with someone who's maybe 18 and a freshman. And so they create those programs for them as well. And then you have people like me who is a young professional that doesn't have really anything for them. And it's actually kind of a weak point in the church in most places, is that there's often a lot of good high school programs, college programs, but not necessarily always good like 22 to like I'm married programs. And so a lot of Newman centers try to fill that gap as well. And in Seattle, they have a really, really nice young adult program through their Newman Center. So I also go to that. And I've interacted with Focus missionaries that work at the University of Washington who know him or he knows them. So it's a cool, like little small world type of gathering there.
Yeah, that's cool. So are they like these groups, are they mostly like single guys, or are there some married guys that show up, like you're saying, in these young adult groups?
It's a mix. So it is pretty like co-gender groups of like guys and girls that show up. It's event based usually. It's like you'll have events that both genders would show up to, and then from there they will do small like men's groups or women's groups that are just single gender. And I would say most of the people that go are single. Married couples, very slim, I think, but a fair amount of dating couples. Like I'm in a relationship, not married. I have quite a few friends that are in relationships that are unmarried that go. But I think once you get into that married life, you know, especially if you're Catholic, maybe you have kids, right? Or, you know, doing something. So I think the time available to do something like that is much lower. But I'd say like probably, if I had to take a rough guess, like 65% single people, like 25% or maybe even 30% relationship unmarried and like
5%. Yeah, it's easier to kind of peel off from the like community events once you're married or if you have kids and stuff. Oh, that's cool. So I guess what topics are you guys typically discussing in these groups?
So it's actually, I think it depends where you're at, like in terms of what's the structure of your group. So for like a small group, that's like those single gender groups, a lot of times they're book based. So you could be reading anything from like a very explicit Bible study that is discussing scripture to some Catholic or Christian book that is about a specific topic, like say it's chastity or say it's about, I don't know, it could be anything, right? It could be a book on like any Catholic or Christian topic. When it goes toward the events, they can be a whole slew of things. So there are recurring Thursday night things. They're called Lumen. I'm not really sure what that name comes from or why it's used, but it acts as sort of a theology on tap, which is a program that you would come and learn about theology, and then you'd go have beers afterwards. So it was like
theology. I think I've actually been to one of those events. And yeah, more so I was at the brewery and like, oh yeah, I'll join your guys' group. No, but in Toledo, there's a, it's called Patron Saints Brewing, and they put those events on.
Oh, sweet.
They're pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I think it's nice because like we come and we learn about topics that are very like unique and interesting. Like one of them was we learned about how like, is Adam and Eve symbolism or is it legit? Like how does, you know, God creating Adam and Eve mesh with the idea that like, okay, we're not all maybe descendants from Adam and Eve, or are we? And like, because a lot of times I think people say it's just symbolism, like even people in the Catholic Church, but there's this person, she had a PhD in like evolutionary biology, was a devout Catholic, and she gave like a 45-minute talk about maybe it's not symbolism, and like how could that really be possible in from like an evolutionary biology standpoint and still align with everything the scripture says. It definitely went a lot over my head because there's a lot of like very intense things, and then she wove in like different Hebrew words that mean slightly different things and how they're used in the Bible, but it's really cool. And then you go and like pray and then drink beer. So
does the church have a stance on that, on Adam and Eve?
So
that's a, I've always wondered, like, because I mean, most of the churches I've been in are more decentralized. There's not really like an authority that weighs in on a lot of topics. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of open for interpretation. So I guess my, like what I've always found kind of interesting within Catholicism is how do you, how does like, does the church have a stance on most topics, and then does it like disseminate down, or is there still a lot of things that are open for interpretation?
Yeah, there tends to be a decent amount of things that are open for interpretation. And then it's like up to like, Rome then to decide like what actually is like needed for them to like have a stance on. And so like when like abortion became big, it was like, all right, it's necessary that they have like a stance on this that is like very, not like fluid, but like very concrete and able for people to like just like look up and like know like this is the stance, this is the truth. But I would say they definitely tend, especially just like in the way of just like how like Christianity is like is meant like for everyone, they tend to have certain times where they're very pointed about their stance, and then also times where they kind of don't give a full answer to allow people to interpretate, just for the sake of being inclusive, which is like a weird thing to kind of like juggle with, like especially when like thinking of just like the idea of like truth itself. But I don't know, I think it's also just like the human factor of it all.
Yeah.
You have the, well, you have like, I think you two also have like the idea of dogma, of like dogma in the church is like, this is the law, right? Like this is stuff that's in the catechism that like is a law. You have to believe it to be in communion with the church. And then there are things that are like, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think with like Adam and Eve in terms of like, is this symbolism? They're like, this might be odd, it's not important enough. Maybe like how you feel about whether it's symbolism or not, maybe isn't important enough for like us to be all in communion together. Like there can be different takes on it, but as Tyler's saying, it's like there are things that we have to all believe together for us to be in communion with each other, and only certain things meet that threshold.
Yeah,
and those are dogma of the church. And other things, it's like not that we don't care about them, but like that they're not as important enough to say like this is something you have to believe to be in communion. You can sort of feel different things about this, and I think it opens it up to some very valuable conversation, and then eventually those things could become dogma. Like the Pope could come out and say, I've written this article or this encyclical or, you know, whatever it is, and I've made something dogma now that we all have to believe. I don't know if there's anything recent like that that's come out. In terms of writings and stuff, there has been like anything that's like, this is now a new crazy belief that we have. So you know.
Yeah, because I'm guessing that most of this is historical.
You have like a tradition of the apostles. Have you heard about like tradition with like a capital T versus tradition?
No, go ahead and explain it.
Okay, so there's like tradition with a lowercase t that we're all familiar with, right? Of like, okay, at Christmas, you know, anyone's tradition, right? Like, it's a tradition that at, I don't know, at LB, you know, in the weight room, you guys count down the number until the first game in like the days and stuff, or like it's tradition that you maybe do a certain cheer before every game, or your little tradition is any type of tradition. When you look at big, like capital T tradition in the church, it's like apostolic tradition, which means the apostles had these teachings that have been passed down since they knew Jesus. And it's that papal succession from Peter as the first pope all the way down. And so the belief there is that it has gone through so much iteration and so much fine tuning that it is correct. That's a kind of a reductive way to say it, but like, it's right is the idea. And we've refined it and thought about it and really ironed out all the kinks. Whereas in some other things, you know, in some other religions, and this is not meant to hate on other religions, but the idea is, you know, they haven't had that sort of such long refinement and fine tuning that we believe that this Catholicism in that way is the most correct thing, because it's had so much refinement. And because of that, we feel what we currently have is true and mostly infallible and mostly like not wrong. Because we would believe that everything that could have been bad, like you think of things where, like in the 1500s, where we were giving out like indulgences for like people paying, right? Like, okay, that was bad. We ironed it out. We believe that we would have gone through all that stuff and mostly marked it bad. I cover everything. There, you think?
No, the 15.
Yeah. Okay. Cool.
Yeah, that's interesting. The indulgences. So they actually did come out against those then. Right, but unfortunately, it was already after like the split.
Yeah.
What? Yeah. I don't know. I hear things from the outside, so I don't know how big they are within the church. But like now, the Latin Mass, for example, seems to be a large topic of discussion. Do you guys have any thoughts, or can you say anything about that?
That's actually funny, because one of the students that I live with is actually part of one of the splits. So it's called SSPX, which is the St. Pius X Society. And so it's very weird. And I think we're like walking like a fine line right now. We're like, he's like a student at UWO. And so like, I am like kind of responsible in a way to continue to like walk with him, but it's also weird because
they're outside of the church, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so basically I think the history of that was that a bishop of the time was like wanting to go against the Pope's decision on Vatican II, basically. And before he died, he appointed like two more bishops, and then they are the ones who started this, like the society. And within that, basically, they just started like approving like their own priests and like starting a side where it was like only Latin Rite masses. And so, technically, the belief then is that there hasn't been someone in the chair of Peter since Pius X, basically, that's been like a valid pope because of like the decision on Vatican II. Which has like been like very unfortunate to witness, like just like this like small schism. It's like nowhere near as large as like the Protestant Reformation or anything like that. It's, I think, not very big yet. But it is like this like weird thing kind of happening within the church right now, of just kind of like a reversal of like when you look at the 70s, 80s, and 90s, of just like how people were like going to church, and it's almost like a more traditional stance, like where they like are like willing to like die almost like to not like to like to, at the thought of like not going to like a Latin mass because like that is like the West like tradition.
So is it that the change was that some of the masses would be in common language, or is it that you cannot give a Latin mass anymore?
Basically it was there. I think whether it was just like noticing within like Vatican II, like noticing within how like the church, we're no longer in like this state of like Christendom, where actually we're more evangelicum, where there's just like most people just don't know about like the Catholic Church, like, or like know a lot about it, or even a lot of people grow up not even knowing like about Christianity. Just like this idea that it's within the Latin Mass, it's like so traditional and so almost like out of time, especially like in America, where like if the average American were to walk into Mass, they'd be like super confused about what's going on. They wouldn't have any understanding. So there's like this lacking of like depth of knowledge that doesn't make it very inclusive, I guess. Which like necessarily isn't like the right way to look at it, especially if you're looking at it from a traditional standpoint. However, basically the document said that we're flipping to what's called like a Norbis Ordo Mass, which is now in English. And then we're like, and it also like changed a few of the intricacies within the Mass of some things now are said aloud by the priest that maybe were like said quietly beforehand, but then some things are also, because like there are certain prayers that like the priest will say that is only for like him and God acting as like the stand-in for Jesus himself. But that only now certain churches that have been like approved by the Pope can. So they limited the number of churches that would be saying the traditional rite mass within like a certain like state or even like region. And so I think like within Wisconsin, there's like three churches that are approved, and then there any others that like were to say the mass would definitely be outside of the Catholic Church.
That's really interesting. I guess that brings up like the larger topic of how much of a duty does the church have to remain traditional, and then I guess counterbalancing that with outreach and moving more towards the environment that it's in.
I think what do you mean by traditional? Do you mean in terms of like doing the Latin rite, or like what are you referring
to? I guess how much does the church need to respond to current events or current like societal trends in order to stay relevant versus being, I guess, unmoving and letting society come back to it?
Yeah. So like, I think I have one of my biggest opinions on this is there used to be a retreat I would go to where it would start on a Friday night and it would go through like a Monday afternoon. And this was for high schoolers. So what that means is like, it would take away a Monday in school. And, you know, for most high schoolers, it would probably miss some sort of game or event that they participated in a Saturday. And the purpose of that retreat was like, this is like the first time, or not the purpose, but like the way it worked is that it was the first time you were doing it, right? As you're doing this retreat, it's not like you go into it where you started meeting all these people through like a day thing or anything. You're going to retreat where you don't know anybody and you don't know anything that the retreat is about. And so 20 years ago, that wasn't like a big deal because a lot of people were very Catholic and a lot of people were very in touch with their faith. And now as we've sort of lost some of that, the numbers have dwindled down. And I think in an example like that, how the church needs to respond is to recognize that and not like obliterate the retreat, but realize like, okay, we've lost this touch. How can we try to start with like an afternoon retreat? Like that sucks that we're taking it from three really awesome days. And I did it and I loved it. It would suck to lose that. But we can't expect people to just go into a three-day retreat out of nowhere anymore, especially when they're in high school. And, you know, starting with maybe a day or even an afternoon, and then encouraging them to go beyond that, I think is really important, because asking someone to do such a huge 180 and miss things in their lives is, at a theological level, the right thing to do, right? It's the right thing to prioritize this stuff, but it's not the realistic thing in society. And I think what we need to recognize in the church is that we can take small steps to get back to where we were 20, 30 years ago, but remaining very steadfast and like unmoving in our ways is not going to get us back to where we were. It's just going to make it worse. And I recognize the goal is to get us back to where we were, but I think we're approaching it in the wrong way. And I think we're being very staunch and not wanting to move. And so I like churches that have been very integrated with social media. I'm personally not a social media user myself anymore, but I think it's such a way that most people connect and interact that I think it's crucial for that to happen. And I think also people that are looking at ways to, you know, do fun things like, okay, you know, maybe we're not going to have a Bible study, or sorry, we're going to have a Bible study, but we're also just going to have something that's like, we're going to all go get beer on Thursday. And like having fellowship opportunities that aren't very deeply Catholic and Christian and so intense, like, because you do need those. But again, it's about opening up that avenue to get society back into the church. And we can't just do that with like a hard hitting thing right away, even though that hard hitting thing and very deep Christian and Catholic level thing is where we want to be. I think there's a lot of churches and people even that are trying to just open with that. And it's really, really hard to make that happen. And I think there's it's something that can be said for having much more open fellowship activities, lower time commitment things that serve as a gateway to that deeper connection. But I also want Tyler to speak on this too, because I feel like he deals with that a lot more with interacting with college kids who have probably fallen away from their faith or trying to get back into it. Yeah. He might have a different opinion than me.
Go for it, Tyler.
Yeah, it is interesting because, like, on one hand, it's like there is like a change that's like needed, and like we see that like within like just like the start of like Focus. So Focus started 20 years ago or 25 years ago now, basically at the turn of the century, and was just like noticing how the college campus, like, students were just like flooding in the college campuses. The university was like basically what the expectation was for when you grew up, was like, okay, like your parents now expect you to go to college. And so we saw like this influx of people flooding in, but like where they were met with was like by institutions that didn't like necessarily like prioritize faith anyway, which they were a public university, so it made sense. But then also that it was just like a melting pot of just like so many like clashing like different like cultures, people, and different things, where I think a lot of people just like get lost in that because they, I don't know, like as we've like kind of seen the change in like the family unit, we've also seen like kind of the change in people like necessarily being prepared for college or like being prepared to be independent, where it's like they're dependent their entire 18 years of life and then they come to 4 years of school to learn how to be independent. It was almost like a babysitting program, whereas in a way, like beforehand, if especially if you were like following your dad into whatever trade he was in or whatever it was, like you were kind of doing that by the age of like 12 or 13. And so I would say like people back 50 years ago, 100 years ago, were much more prepared to be independent than they are today. And so then like, just like within that, like a lot of the students that like I work with are just like trying to figure out like the basic necessities, like learning how to cook for themselves or do laundry or like stuff like that, which is like very weird. But that's just like almost like, it's just like, we're almost like a basicness now of just like, of students coming in where it's like, it's like first, just like loving them well and trying to be their friend, but then also just like kind of like being a big brother where it's like teaching them a lot of things that are even like outside of faith. And I think just something that has still resonated though, which I'll stamp on, is like just like this idea that like truth doesn't like change no matter like the time, no matter the season, no matter the era, like truth is in itself. And so like the thing that I've seen like draw students in the most is like tradition of the church, and like within that is like the Eucharist, within that is like Eucharistic adoration, even like just like very like solemn and like reverent masses, where like being like reverent like before like the Eucharist, or being reverent like at like mass like matters, where like I'm actually reading this book called like The Lamb's Supper, which focuses on just like the importance of mass and how that like differs of like it's like a differs from like a service that maybe is held by like a similar Christian non-denominational church. And just like the fact that like there's like something different there that actually like is supposed to like attract and excite people. And so I would say that like there is like a level of like the Latin mass and like tradition that does like excite people in a different way, where it's like maybe it's like very slow, but it's like, but this is different than the rest of the world with the what the world is offering me. And I necessarily don't know if I want it or not in regards. regard to like how a lot of students will encounter it, but they like recognize that there is like a difference, which is like intriguing.
Yeah, I feel personally, I've seen a lot of hunger for the more traditional, I think.
Mm-hmm. Especially in our generation.
I've seen a lot of people very curious about Catholicism or Orthodox Christianity, or just trying to go back further. But then I definitely see why you would want to outreach towards people that aren't there. So I guess, is there, there's kind of a layered progression to like move people towards the deeper?
Basically what, like how like Focus models it, is called like this idea of like win, build, and send. And so like the first layer is just like winning people over who like necessarily maybe have never had a good experience with like someone who's Catholic, or maybe have never even heard of like what Catholicism is or know who Jesus Christ is. And so it's just like a lot of like things we do then is just like for that like wide variety of people. So like our first like Friday night on campus, we had like a large like capture the flag game like on campus. Basically, we were like running between the buildings and stuff. And so like that's like meant to like kind of like include everyone, like where you don't need to have any belief whatsoever. You just like need to just desire some level of community. And then the next like thing is like a build where people who like have like kind of made it known that like whether they're Catholic or not Catholic, but they desire to like learn more. It's then like we have these opportunities then to like maybe work with them like one-on-one, and whatever that may look like. And then the last one, like send, is this idea of like St. Therese. I like that this like little way of evangelization, which is kind of like the thought of like when you look back at like Jesus and like his disciples, was that like Jesus Christ could have come to like every person within the world, like in that moment just appeared as he's like God. But at the same time, it's like he saw how, and God knows that like it's just the ways in which the effectiveness of like each person just like loving and even just like investing in three or four people, and then each of those doing the same thing, like in a way sounds much like a pyramid scheme, which is always really funny when we talk about it, but is like ultimately like the way in which like spiritual multiplication is like an idea. And so those are like, I would say like the tiers of just like what like you're eventually like asking people, but like in the beginning, it's just like, you just like want to meet them where they're at. And so wherever that is, whether it's like they're coming in from a Catholic family of like 12 and like they've heard every jargon thing and they went to Catholic school where they're homeschooled by their parents, whatever it is, or it's like a kid from maybe like Milwaukee who like has never heard of like anything, but yeah, maybe he doesn't even like come around that often, but like I just get to like meet him like where he's at and like have conversations about like the chastity they're struggling in with like when he's on campus, or maybe it's like the sobriety and like wanting to like go to parties all the time or whatever it is. It's just kind of like the small like different like tiers of like, yeah, just like what kind of Matt was saying, just like kind of doing outreach to the people of where.
So do you see much difference, like compare yourself to say like Campus Crusade or like other ministries that are not Catholic? Mm-hmm. Are you both doing pretty much the same thing, or if you could pick out some differences, what do you think they would be?
Yeah, it's interesting because like the model's definitely like used and well versed in by just like any like non-denominational out, like especially in looking at like collegiate ministry, where like Focus, actually the founders of Focus, they went to Scott Hahn specifically, and then also the founder of Crew, I can't remember what his name is, but like basically to like kind of like figure out what their model would be for like trying to expand to like all the different universities around the US. And so a lot of what we do is very much modeled after Crew and is like is shared by a number of different denominations. I would say like the biggest things, like a lot of them like tend to focus in like group studies, which like have their place, but then I would say what's like different is the fact that we do like a lot of like one-on-one things. So like that looks like discipleship, where like it kind of focuses specifically on like how like Jesus would have invested like one-on-one with mm-hmm. like one of the 12 disciples. And so I think that's honestly where like I tend to see like the most growth and probably the difference between like us and like some of the other like organizations on campus. I'd also say that Focus itself at least how I've seen it, especially on different campuses, tends to be a little more present on campus, just because like we, like they hire people who like recently graduated from college. And whereas a lot of like the, at least in Oshkosh and then some of the universities I've been at, they tend to have like maybe like one head guy who's like probably been in with crew for a while. And then a lot of like their outreach is actually helped by like students who are already on campus, like student leaders. And they just like don't necessarily have like the time to be giving like as much as like I would as a full-time job. And so I would say like in that way too, just like we're able to just like to work more hours, like really like on campus.
Do you have any idea what the international scene is like for this type of outreach? Like the American versus anywhere else?
I don't know. Yeah, I only know what it is like in Focus, because I really don't know any other organization. I know Crew is like much larger than even Focus is in the U.S., but I don't know how much wider actually. Focus currently is in like 5 or 6 different countries. So I think like Mexico. Yeah, I think it's Mexico, and then I think the other 4 or 5 are all in Europe. And so a few of those are like Germany and France, and then Austria. Ireland and maybe the UK, but like basically it's just like a team of like, because one of the guys that I was friends with last year, he actually got sent out to Germany, and so it's like a 3-year commitment. But for many missionaries within Focus, that tends to be more like lifelong mission, where like they kind of have a family now and they like dedicated like moving to that country, and then they just like kind of are like spending time with the people that are there, which like, especially even like the university system within like Europe is like very different than the US is. And also like a lot of the time, like they're kind of working a lot within like the young adult scene as well, with like a lot of like young families. So I know it's very different than like what I would be doing here in the US.
Do you have any thoughts on, this is probably a tough question, but Catholicism in general in America, like, is it similar to Catholicism and the rest of the world, and how does it fit into American culture versus, say, European or South American?
Sure. So,
do you have any thoughts about it?
A little bit, yeah. I think when you look at, I'm going to talk about like Latin American countries a little bit, because I've traveled to a few of them, and it seems like it's just so ingrained in their culture as like a thing, because like, I don't know, it's like, I don't know a ton of Protestant people or even like non-Christian people that live in some of those countries, whereas you have something like the US that is such a melting pot of ethnicities and religions that you're always going to have a little bit of, you know, pull towards other things. But like some of the very Catholic countries like Latin America or Italy, just because people are Catholic and it would maybe seem to be more ingrained in their culture, they're not really practicing always. So I think I read a statistic that was like 80% of people in Italy are Catholic, mm-hmm. which is like wild. Only 30% are really practicing. And I feel like it's probably similar in Latin America. So I think that first number in the US, like 80%, we're not going to have that in the US, of like how many people are actually Catholic. But I do feel like probably our second number will be relatively similar, of like, you know, 80% to 30. If let's say we have like 20, maybe we have like 7% are actually practicing. So I think the level of attrition in terms of actually practicing people is probably similar, but I think there's something to be said about, like, you could go talk to more people in those countries who would be like, oh yeah, I'm Catholic, or I have some of this experience being Catholic, whereas I don't think you necessarily have as high of a chance doing that here in the US. But I would say, I think it's, in some ways, it's cool thing about the US is you talk to different people and learn about their faith, and there's two benefits of that in my eyes, which one would be like an informing thing of like, oh, this is how this person connects with God like their God or their religion through X, Y, and Z. Like I can maybe apply that to my religion, even though it's not the same thing. Like you learn different ways to get in touch with yourself. Or, and this is kind of a hot topic in Catholicism, like yoga.
Is it really a hot topic?
Right.
Still? Like still it is?
Yeah. Like should you
very really anti-yoga. Yeah.
Yeah. Like should you be practicing yoga? And it's like, I won't get into that, but like there's certain things about other religions that you can remove the religious aspect to, maybe, and practice them for your health benefits and stuff. And on the other side, you have things where you're like, ooh, like they believe this, which is in direct conflict of what I believe. Why do I believe this then? Like you're presented with that conflict. And I think it helps reaffirm and give yourself a deeper understanding of what you believe and why. And I'm not saying you wouldn't get that in other countries. I just think you'd have a greater likelihood. And I'm saying that based on zero fact whatsoever. But I have to assume, since we have a like such a higher diversity of like everything in the US, that you encounter so many different types of people that would hit you with that and really make you think about it more so than you necessarily would in other countries. But I don't know that for sure. Do you have any thoughts on that, Tyler?
I can't really talk too much about like Latin America. I don't have too much experience, but I like on the European side, I think in comparison and contrast to America, just like, cause I went on a study abroad for like 3 or 4 months and I encountered a lot of European like friends that I made in that time frame, and none of them were Catholic, but like they all knew of the Catholic Church. So like a lot of them were like from like France, Germany, just like very like culturally Catholic areas of, like throughout history. So they like knew of it, but they necessarily like I would say there is definitely a difference in America in the sense of like in my experience that like our generation, like the younger generation, is much more like on fire and much more just like held in support in a way. Like I would say like our cardinals and our bishops and even our churches are like are trying very hard. Whereas like it definitely seems like the older church, like looking at like Europe, is like going through a lot of like pains and struggles right now that like we necessarily don't experience in like some of the bishops and just like their people, where it kind of seems like it's become like moot in a way, where like it's just like everyone's like culturally aware of Catholicism, but no one actually like has like much desire or drive to like kind of like expand the church. Like it feels like it's just like kind of hit like a breaking point in a way where like I don't know, I think if like you've seen like some like the like recent news on like a lot of like the bishops in Germany and different things, like there seems to just be like kind of like a—
Can you talk about that? I don't think I know what you're referring to.
There was just like a number, especially like with like the current Pope who's like within the church, there's been kind of like not a hard stance on kind of like a lot of like the new like LGBTQ and looking at transitioning and like same-sex marriage and different things like that. Like there hasn't been like a very—
Yeah, he put out a statement on it, right?
And I think—
So what is it?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, he put out a statement.
They're not allowed to be married in the church, but the union can be blessed. Is that—
So basically, I don't think the union itself can be blessed, but the people can be. And so it's like it's saying that like, yeah, like people who identify as gay can still like receive a blessing just as like anyone else would if they were to ask, but they can't, like, we can't like bless their marriage. It's like basically what— and then I think a lot of like story writers like took that, was like the Pope like says you can bless gay people, was like what like the story came up, which is like, I think people like had like a weird reaction to it where it's like, no, like that should be the truth, because like everyone deserves to be like, to be able to receive like a blessing from God, like via like a priest if like asked. And but yeah, basically like a number of the German bishops have like kind of like come out and have been like for same-sex marriages being like allowed in the church and like being able to be blessed. And so which I think is just like, especially like in Germany, they've just experienced like this very just like, I don't know what the word is exactly, but in talking with my friend who's like living there currently, they're just, especially like in Berlin, they're very eccentric. And
I think that's been Berlin for the last at least 100 to 200 years.
Yeah. But just like, I think they've become like less traditionally, like a culturally traditional, in many bouts of life. And so I think they're just like seeing how like the church is like dying within Germany in ways of just like people just like necessarily don't feel welcomed because of like how they identify or whatever it is. And so the bishop's like response have been, well, how can we change how we're like allowing people in? But I don't know. I think that's like where we're kind of like talking earlier about like, what's the line of like, where like truth ends and begins. And then also like where like we're like welcoming, but also like firm in like tradition of like the church.
Yeah, it's definitely a difficult thing to balance. I mean, if you see somebody in what you would consider to be sin, you wouldn't really want to push them away at that time. But yeah, you also can't really support it.
Which, I think especially how like the person like receives like criticism nowadays, or like if you're against this one thing about me, then like you hate me, you know, type of thing, where like I think there's just like this reality, like looking outside like faith, of just like people like tend to not be able to just like receive like something very well, like I think, which is because we're very feelings based and like passions based culture. It seems especially like online too, of like if you like disagree in this one area, then you disagree with like this entire person, which like isn't the truth. But especially like how I think we've like kind of been manipulated in like the reception of argumentation, or the reception of just like how I feel is like the truth. Then I think those like clashing, like I think is like, yeah, done a lot of like, has had a lot of problems within the world itself, but also like just even within the church.
You see it too. I agree. How does the church handle its history? So I'd say you had somebody come up to you at one of your events and is like, hey, what do you guys say about the Inquisition or about Crusades, things like that?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
Is that a topic of discussion that's very popular, or is it? No, not at all.
I wouldn't say just like, because like, yeah, like Matt was talking about like the history of the church is like so large. It, like, yeah, and this is also like a thing, like there's like a level of like failure. Like, I mean, even looking at like, besides like the breaking down of like the family unit, which also is like, has like hurt this, like we've like sent a lot of like that education into like RCIA or like CCD, which is like basically like from like first grade through like eighth grade, you just like receive like your Catholic education. If you were at a public school, or then if you were at a private like Catholic school, then you'd like receive it all the years that you were at the Catholic school. And so I'd say for people who were at like a Catholic school from either like K through 12 or K through 8, their knowledge of like the history of the church is definitely more in depth, because of like meeting like once on a Sunday for an hour throughout like 8 years, like you only get through so much. And especially trying to receive the Inquisition at like the age of 13, like you either you don't care, or it's like over your head and it doesn't matter. And then also just like the level of teaching that like happens. And so I would say like a lot of like that history then is like put into either like the family to like teach, if that like is something like important enough, or is like something that you just have to do. Like,
what about like which about like missions and the Americas? Like, I know in Canada, it seems like there's been this pushback, which it seems that some of the historical facts were not correct, but that like indigenous people, they found like a grave or something. And then there were churches that were burned down in Canada recently, I think, or at least, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, again, I think that's like not something well taught. And I would say definitely like even within the Catholic Church, like there definitely has always been a pretty bad response to like when we see like imperfection in the church, or like even just like outright just like horrid things that like maybe someone within the church has done, like we tend to just like ignore it. It's just like, because like the church is just big enough that it can just like, we'll move on. Like the way that like media floods nowadays, it's like people move on to something that, like a week later, which is like very, very sad to see, just because like, yeah, the response should be like more contrite and recognition of just like the imperfection of like any human institution that even like with the aid of God is like still flawed. So yeah, I would say like even then it's like, yeah, still up to the person to like have their own curiosity or like desire to learn about it. But like it necessarily isn't pushed by anything other than like, I would say like the one thing is like depending on the priest at the church, like, cause he has like the apostolic power to like invest in a lot of the community. If like he were to so desire to like speak on this, whether it was like at a mass on Sunday or even to like start to like host something within the church. But it's definitely not like unilateral within the church. It's definitely like based on the specific church.
So there'll be no crusades coming up soon.
I doubt it. Yeah, I really hope not, especially the way that kind of the rest of the world's looking, like Israel and Ukraine and Russia. And
the Pope has been pretty pretty neutral, pretty I guess dovish on a lot of those situations, right?
Yeah, kind of just, I'm basically just like calling for peace, that both sides just like stop fighting now. Which I think in looking at just like the call for life is like the stance. Because like neither of them appear to be like really just wars, which also gets into another topic of just like justification of war. But I don't know, like in regard to like the church's stance on life, like I think a lot of times people only associate that with like abortion. But like life extends, like, yeah, much larger than that. And so I'm appreciative of like that call, because I think that is something that I think people tend to focus only on like the beginning of life. But there's a lot to like more to that stance of just like, if like we really have like the pursuance of life, then that looks a lot more holistically than just the conception of it.
There's like so many interesting topics like that. Like I'm around DC, so by the Catholic University of America, and one of my friends goes there and hung out with some people the one night, and they're talking about IVF and things like that. Like there's so many different like little niche topics you can get into in that regard.
Yeah.
That's a very interesting one. I had a long conversation with somebody about that. And like, you know, some things in the Catholic Church are like, you do some like good stuff to outweigh the bad. Like, I don't know. So the Catholic Church is okay with like drinking beer, right? And drinking alcohol, even though alcohol is not necessarily a good thing for our bodies, right? Same thing with like sugar, right? Or like caffeine. Like you could argue those are just like inherently not good things for you, but we don't have that restriction on them because they, in some ways, if you're drinking beer with like friends, if you're building that fellowship, like that's very important, right? And you're probably not causing like tons of harm to your body unless you're really getting into that state of drunkenness. So it's like the good of that outweighs the bad. And when you look at something like IVF, it's, you know, you could argue that, well, you're having a kid, right? And you're bringing a kid into the world. And, like, that's a very positive thing, like building up the family unit. But then it like conflicts directly with like teaching about how you're supposed to conceive and how you're supposed to create that family. And it's very niche. And like, I feel like I've had so many conversations about it that I have kind of wrapped myself into like a loop of like, I don't really know how I feel about it. And it's one of those things that I'm still kind of grappling with, because I think it would be very hard for a family who wanted to have a kid to not be able to do that if that method existed. But at the same time, you're grappling with like, if I can't do it naturally, am I being called by God to not have a kid? And am I maybe being called to adopt or something like that? So it's a very, very touchy subject because, you know, then you deal with like, okay, all the eggs that you fertilized, right? And if we as Catholics believe that birth starts or life starts at conception, then are all those eggs, fertilized eggs, people? And like, I would think that I would say yes. Like,
that's actually exactly what this, it was, yeah, it was more of like an ethics conversation, yeah. And they were natural law. That was like their philosophy. So the conclusion ends up being crazy from their standpoint. Their standpoint is that you just leave the eggs alone because you can't dispose of them. And it's also not correct to like implant them. Which is a,
yeah, that's kind of where I'm at too. But it's like you have to pay, right? I think quite a substantial fee to freeze them and manage them. But it's like, I think if you're doing something like IVF, you get yourself into a position where you have to commit to that. Like, you have to be willing to pay. If you feel like you're a devout Catholic and you agree with all this, then you can't touch them, right? You can't do anything with them. It's so weird. It's such a, yeah, it's a very niche like edge case that has made me.
But by, so. I mean, that same philosophy could be applied to almost any form of technology or biotechnology then too. Like natural law, like they'll say, like, it's the, what is the exact wording? Basically, like the natural intent of a fetus is to, or of, not of a fetus, of a, like an ovum, of an egg, is to be fertilized. And like the natural intent of a womb is to be fertilized in a certain way and to bear a child. But I think you could almost make that argument, like the IVF argument, against any sort of like medical intervention.
Mm-hmm. Just like, it's not like the natural law of it, you're saying? Interesting. I've always considered that, like, this is not exactly what you're talking about, but like, just in regard to like any type of like surgery a lot of people do, of just like, oh, like plastic surgery, even like looking at like a lot of like teeth, like I feel like look at braces or something, like, oh, is this changing you out of like God's likeness and image? You know, is this like trying to like take control of how you desire to look, that is like different than like how you're created to look? Which is like such a, like an interesting argument, because like I would say most people would be like, oh, plastic surgery, that's a line, but maybe like wouldn't say the same thing about like any oral type of surgery or any,
Can be all kinds of things, I think.
But it's like people didn't necessarily have to deal with that like thousands of years ago because they didn't have the technology for it. You know, it was just like, oh, I just like live how I am, you know, and that's like the natural law.
So like what I would say in this scenario is like, this is where we as Catholics, I think, have the really nice benefit of leaning on the Pope and the cardinals for stuff like this, and leaning on the catechism, where it's like, I mean, like, I feel like I could feel some way about this, and like, maybe I shouldn't based on this thing, but maybe I should based on this thing. And we as Catholics can form our own opinion on it, but we necessarily don't always have to be in communion with our religion, because if the Pope and the cardinals haven't come out with some way that they feel about it, it in some ways, again, as we described earlier, it doesn't matter. And like, doesn't matter is maybe not the right way to say that, but like, if they haven't said you can or can't get braces and something like that, it, in some ways, it doesn't really matter what you decide to do. And it becomes sort of that, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but it sort of becomes that personal decision of like, if you go one way or the other, it doesn't really matter in terms of God's overarching plan, because Pope hasn't said that it matters, which is kind of a beautiful thing, because then you don't have to be like, you know, did I do the right thing necessarily? And yeah, I think it's like a nice thing that we have as Catholics to kind of rely on that a little bit.
But then I guess then does the church have to make a statement on like almost any emerging technology?
Mm-hmm. I think they do on, you may have a different opinion, but I think they would on the important yeah. things. Like, I think if they don't, then either A, they're drafting it, and it's going to come out, or B, it's like, you, this is up for you, you know, to debate, or, you know, you mm-hmm. fall maybe on your bishops or your priests to like tell you and think about that. I know there are certain things that the United States Council of Catholic Bishops will put out about, so like we talked about earlier, like fiduciary supplicans was that thing about, you know, the blessing of different people. Like the USCCB put stuff out about that. And so it's like at different levels of the hierarchical church, you'll have people tell you different things that you should and shouldn't care about. And that is helpful, I think. But I think if they haven't said anything particular about a piece of technology and you maybe feel weird about it, you can go talk to your priest. But I think in some ways it's also a personal yeah. decision at that point. And you should use your conscience. I think there's a lot of talk in the, or maybe a lack of talk in the church about the Holy Spirit and using your conscience as a guiding light. And I think most of us would know, like, am I really altering some aspect of my body or doing something that I shouldn't be doing? And you can, if there's no specific teaching on it, you mm-hmm. kind of have to rely on your conscience in that way.
Which is, it's interesting. I mean, say you're born deaf and there's a treatment to cure your deafness. Like, were you intended to be deaf? No. Like, could you have used that, like, to show Christ or something? And then, by, you know what I mean? Something like that.
Yeah. I want to say that St. Thomas Aquinas had, like, a lot of, like, writings, in engaging in, like, just, like, science in general. And just, like, how, like the usage of science actually is, like, a benefit of, like, Christianity and Catholicism and, like, proving a different facets of like the history of the church, but also in just like the utilization of it, like in like the current time. And I want to say that there was either like something like either the church has like talked, like made a point on based on his writings, or if it was something within that of like utilizing like this, like the technology and science for the sake of improving life is never something that's like against like God's desire for us. Like where like he wants our life to be improved. And like then how to like discern that is like what I was saying with like the Holy Spirit is like, is this actually like benefiting my life, or is this actually just like yeah. a desire of my own that like I just like want this thing? And so like for the deaf child, I think that that's a benefit yeah. to life.
Maybe. I don't know. I really don't know. It's like I think you guys brought up social media earlier. It's like, how do you discern if that mm-hmm. you can do a lot of great things with it, you can do a lot of bad, say artificial intelligence. I mean, you could just like almost every new technology, I think you could make a for and against.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say this is going to be kind of a weird reductive example, but like I can do a lot of things with my fists. Like I could
yeah.
crap out of somebody, right? Or I could build a house for someone who doesn't have it, right? So of course there's going to be pieces of new technology that come out, and most of them you can probably do good with. So another weird example, maybe the most brutal one, is like gunpowder, right? Like I could create a weapon and harm a lot of people, or I could, you know, this is really weird. Again, really weird example, and I acknowledge that. Like I could use that to create dynamite and control avalanches for people who are skiing yeah. and protect them, right? And again, very weird example, I know that, but every piece of technology, every part of our bodies can be used for good or evil. And I think what we're called to do is to use them for good and to evangelize and educate others to use them for good. Again, nuclear technology, it can be used for tons of harm, but it can be also used as a huge source of energy. So I think when you look at every piece of technology, the idea is not should we be using this, but how do we make sure it's used for good? And how do we ensure that that is its main focus?
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. Do we want to shift to Lent? You talk about that?
Sure. Yeah.
Give us just like a brief like rundown of it and how you practice it.
Sure. So Lent historically starts on Ash Wednesday, which is normally forget what, like, basically, like, within, like, the liturgical calendar, there's, like, different cycles of seasons. And so Lent is one of the, like, four other seasons that isn't ordinary times. Lent, Advent.
Christmas, Easter.
Mm-hmm. Like, four other. Yeah. And so basically within, like, the liturgical calendar of the church, there's, like, a series of a cycle known as Lent, and that is for 47 days technically, but it's, like, known as, like, 40 days because, like, Sundays technically aren't counted within that cycle, but it's, like, the days leading up to Easter. And so a lot of, like, this is, like, kind of, like, spent in, like, preparation for the celebration of Easter. But, like, we all, like, I guess, like, know the story of, like, Jesus, like, being sacrificed, like, upon the cross is, like, cause for celebration because of what happens after, but everything, like, leading up to it is, like, a state of mourning. And so similarly, Lent is kind of like that, like, mourning preparation of our hearts for the celebration of Easter, but also for, like, the recognition of, like, the sacrifice of Christ. And so, but yeah, starts on Ash Wednesday, and then I think it's, like, technically the Sunday then starts, like, the Lent season, but, like, right before that is, like, there's, like, known as, like, Ash Thursday, Ash Friday, Ash Saturday, I guess. But that is where, like, basically people will go to, like, receive ashes upon their forehead. And this is symbolism for one of the parts in scripture where it talks about, like, from like, dust you were made, and, like, into dust you will return, basically. It was, like this acknowledgement that, like, God has given me everything that I have, and, like, without Him, like, I actually am unable to do any, like, truly anything. Like, my very life is, like, held within the balance that, like, He continues to, like, love and, like, desire for me to be alive. And then with, like, within that is, like, this reality that, like, only thing that would have saved me from not becoming dust again and just, like, decaying in the ground is the fact that, like, Jesus has come to earth in the form of the resurrection to reopen basically the gates of heaven for us to, like, re-enter into upon, like, our death. And so this, like, season then is, like, spent a lot of time, like, in fasting. So people will, like, look at to just, like, kind of the different ways in which, like, they maybe, like, take it for granted certain aspects of their life. And in which case then, like, their entire 40 days is, like, spent in, like, gratitude for, like, not only the resurrection and the sacrifice, but also, like, just the many different ways, like, God is continually blessing them or their family. And then ultimately it's, like, yeah, culminated by, like, the celebration of Easter. But then also, like, leading up to the last week before Easter is, like, what is known as, like, Jesus' passion. And so we look at then within, like, the gospel of, like, all this after time spent with the disciples before, like, He then enters into the agony of the garden and then prepares to be sacrificed and treated by the Jews and the Romans via, like, the scourging, via the crown of thorns, and ultimately leading us up to, like, Holy Thursday and Good Friday, which are, like, part of the Triduum, which is special solemnity days within the liturgical calendar, and then, like, finally culminating Easter, which at that point then, like, a lot of fasting ends and you then, like, celebrate. So
what is the fasting like now? Because it's changed, yeah, a lot, right?
Yeah, so even like looking at, like, the receiving, like, the Eucharist, like, that's, like, changed within the church of, like, how, like, it used to be, like, you wouldn't eat anything like 12 hours before you would, like, receive it, and, like, now it's, like, an hour beforehand. So, like, something like the church has, like, changed, like, some things where like, something that's, like, held within, like, it's kind of, like, universal is, like, the fasting from meat on Fridays, and so this is, like, every Friday in Lent in preparation for Good Friday, and finally, like, Easter is that, like, yeah, no meat is, like, to be consumed that day by you. But then, like, things like eggs or fish are, like, considered, like, allowable, which is, like, I think always been, like, a topic of discussion for people, like, if that actually is, like, how it should be or not. Because I know, like, yeah, it used to, like, almost, like, be, like, a bread and water fast type of ordeal. But then other than that, there generally doesn't seem to be, like, a universal, like, fast given. And so, like, a lot of times then it's, like, left up to the individual to, like, kind of, like, gauge their life and see, like, what things maybe draw them away from God. And so, like, a lot of, like, people recently, especially with the continual like development of technology have like ingrained like the usage of like social media or the usage of their phone, watching movies, TV shows, whatever, into their fasting. But then also like is like this idea of like consumption of like people like will give up like sweets or they'll give up chocolate, things that are like considered like pleasures that necessarily they don't need. But then also like people have like started to like add into their fasting, like instead of like taking away like something like out of their day, they want to add like 20 minutes of like silent prayer, or maybe they want to add like praying the rosary every day. They want to add working out 3 times a week, or they want to add like cold showers instead of warm showers. And so a lot of these things, what I've been talking about are like different fasts that like Exodus holds, which is a intensive fasting that was created a couple of years ago by some Catholic men who basically just desired to like have a more like deliberate and kind of extreme version of Lent. And so a lot of what it was, yeah, like cold showers every day, praying a holy hour every day. So like an hour of prayer, maybe like reading a book, not using any social media, not really using their phone at all, except for like work related things or like communication things related to like texting their wife, mm-hmm. texting like a friend or whatever, or like replying to emails, whatever it was. And then also like in regard to like, they also fast from no meat on Wednesdays, and then there's like no snacking at all. And it's only 3 meals, but then on Wednesday and Fridays, it's actually only like 1 large meal and like 2 small meals. Different things like this, that they just kind of ingrained like a bunch of like disciplines. And these disciplines were ultimately like supposed to kind of like strip you of a lot of the either like comforts or pleasures that you have, for the sake of like really entering into like how, like in a way, like how like much of the world, especially outside of America, actually like experiences life. Of just like they just like aren't like able to like have every single like comfort that maybe we have, or even just like looking at like actually how much like did Jesus like suffer throughout that time leading up to the cross, and like do we actually just like completely live in like comfort the entire time? But like in the embracement of sacrifice, does it actually allow us to like enter into a small way what his sacrifice like felt like? And in which case does that allow us then to like kind of understand this kind of embracement of pain that actually calls us out of ourselves and actually allows us to give of ourselves more? We actually then aren't like living for ourselves personally, but able to like sacrifice for others. And so like all these things like brought up in Lent is like, yeah, for the eventual just like death to self. This is idea that my life is actually worth like giving to others. And the more that I take from my life, the more I actually.
Is it supposed to mimic Christ in the wilderness? The 40 days aspect?
It's, yeah, I think that is like what like is considered the, symbolism of like a similar thing of like, yeah, we're going out into the desert for 40 days and like suffering. I think like historically speaking, like that doesn't like line up exactly with like chronologically, like Christ's life, but like in regard to
is the rest of the liturgical calendar followed? For some reason, it seems like there's always been like more emphasis on Lent than the rest of the year for me, mm-hmm. outside of the
Yeah, no, agreed. I would say, yeah, Advent definitely gets a bad rap. Because, like, I would say that, like, is a similar time of the year that it's, like, supposed to be very, very celebrated, like Lent. But also, like, looks different because I think Lent is so popularized. I think the simple fact of, like, nothing matters if the cross didn't exist, or, like, if, like, the resurrection didn't exist. And so, like that like focal point I think is why like Lent is like kind of like held in much higher regard versus like Advent, for example, like leads up to Christ's birth, which is like an important point in history. But it's like if Christ never like dies on the cross and dies for all of our sins, then like we're actually not able to really like kind of have this like hope and belief in like heaven after. So
yeah, I think with Advent it's Christmas is a joyful time, and even all the parts leading up to it are joyful. Whereas, and like you're supposed to prepare your heart, right? In Advent, I think that's like what they say is like prepare your heart for Jesus is coming and do a lot of that. But with Lent, it's like Easter is very celebratory, but the Triduum, mm-hmm. the 3 days before, are horrible. Like they're very sad. They're very hard to get through, because it was when Jesus was tortured and died and all those things. And so it's about like kind of a solemn 40 days of sacrifice and being there with Jesus and, you know, acknowledging what he went through for all of that. So I think there's like a sense of sacrifice more so and less joy for those 40 days, such that you have such a, like such an explosive celebration on Easter. Whereas with Advent, it's, you don't really have that. Like Mary and Joseph suffered a little bit to like go from where they grew up all the way to Bethlehem, but it's mostly joyful throughout that season. And it's about preparing yourself and making sure you're ready also with Advent, since it's the beginning of the liturgical year, like making sure you're ready and available for the entire year, right? So yeah, I think there's, I definitely think there's some difference. And I think it's because of the end of each of those seasons and how they impact what you have to go through and how you prepare during the previous days.
How about, I'm going to change topics on you guys again, but yeah, thank you for that. Significance of Mary. That is just something that I think is like completely stripped away in any sort of non-denominational or Protestant church.
I don't know why that like tends to be such like a hot button topic for people, and maybe it's like the ways in which like I don't know, it's almost like people like kind of just like encounter knowledge of like the ways in which like Catholicism holds like Mary in such reverence, I think from the outside can just appear as if it's like something that's not. And so like when I talk with a lot of people who aren't Catholic about that, they have like said that like it appears that we like worship Mary, or it appears that like Mary is held higher than like anyone else in the church, which like in reality like is very true in the fact that like she's like the mother of God, like the mother of Jesus. And so like there's to a certain extent that like she does deserve reverence, especially within the belief that like she was the only person on earth after Jesus to be like sinless, to be full of grace, is something that's like never been held by like any of the saints within the church, never been held by anyone to the Catholic Church knowledge. And so there's like just like this level to which like reverence is due, but I think like how that appears from the outside then is that like there's some ways in which we're like putting her up as a god, comparable to Jesus or to God, which I think is untrue in the way in which like if you actually like talk with someone who was like understanding of the Catholic Church position in on Mary, that they would be able to go into like the intricacy of that. But I think like just from like an outside perspective, like as holistically, like it does look like Mary is like held in this manner that like she shouldn't be.
I think the best way to like think about it, if you've never seen it or never experienced it, is I know a lot of non-denominational people that will pray to deceased family members and say like, you know, watch over like grandpa or grandma, like watch over me and like please be with me for something as simple as like this basketball game, or like I don't know, like as I'm getting married, like I know you're here watching over me. So it's like they believe that that sort of communication channel is present. That's how Catholics feel about Mary. And like we believe that that communication channel is present with Mary, and that we're able to pray to her and ask her to pray for us. And I think that the beautiful thing about Mary is she is the only human.
So where, hold on a second, where does that come from? Okay. I think that is like one of the key like differences right there, is if Mary was without sin, or if she was a virgin.
What?
Like the belief that like she like never sinned. So,
So the belief that she never sinned is two parts, right? The belief that she was born without original sin, that's the Immaculate Conception that we celebrate. And that's because, you know, you believe like God created all of us, right? He created her in that way such that she could be prepared to be the mother of Jesus. And then the belief that she never sinned is, I guess that kind of why do we believe like anything? I guess in the Catholic Church, it's through the interpretation of the Bible and the scripture that we believe that happened. And if she was born without original sin and was so pure to the point that she could hold the baby Jesus and be his mother, that she would have led such that life as his first disciple and would have never sinned and been in a sinful state. So it is a belief, right? I don't know if in the Bible it actually explicitly states she never sinned.
The only thing that like what it's like drawn from is when the angel Gabriel like appears before her, and like this is where we get like the Hail Mary prayer is where it talks about like Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee, and just this idea that like she is like full of like God's grace, and so like only based on like God giving her like the fulfillment of His grace is she able to not sin, but it's like not through like her own. Merit or the like of like anything that she
so then doing. I guess this is probably a minor detail, but a lot of other denominations hold that Jesus had siblings. Does he not have siblings in the Catholic faith?
No, because basically like, and yeah, I've had this conversation a couple of times, which like it ultimately comes down to the how people interpretate the Bible based on the translations and like almost a loss of translation that's like happened through the Bible, like becoming English, where basically the word brother is like the best way in English we can describe
cousin
being said
is what I've
but
heard.
How it was used in whatever language they were speaking at the time. It was before Aramaic maybe, I don't know. But like basically like the word means like brethren, which is like could be brothers, cousins, second cousins. They're like it's cut like a family like type of like use of whatever the word they had. And so from my knowledge, like the times where like people will say like, oh, I think like John was his brother, it was like John was his cousin. But like we just like don't say that like, in the Bible for whatever reason. I don't know why they allow it, they continue to say brother, or what the tradition is, but
that's interesting. Yeah. So then I think you did bring up an important part on that. And I guess this would apply to saints also, that you pray to them to pray on your behalf. You don't pray to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Like, I think the idea is, so like in the Hail Mary prayer, you have like Hail Mary, full of grace, Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. And so the belief is like, Mary is this direct path to Jesus, this direct path to God. And just as you would ask maybe a priest to pray for you, or I could ask you to pray for me or anybody else that's living, we can also ask them to pray for us. And they are this person that had such a direct connection to God, so much so that in the case of the saints, they were beatified by the Pope. And so it's asking this person who has a very close relationship with God to pray for us and to be at our side and to add some oomph, I guess, to whatever prayer we are praying. And so I think that people pray to St. Thomas Aquinas, as Tyler was saying, he was very science-based person. They'll pray to him before tests and say like, hey, can you please pray for me? St. Thomas Aquinas, like, watch over me as I'm taking this test. And so it's very similar in that regard, where we're asking Mary, who was the closest person to Jesus, realistically, to pray for us to him and to bring us to Jesus, because she is the only human. Like, we talk about Jesus coming down and being a human, but he is still God. Like, she is the only person that was a human, that was born without sin, and that was so holy and so close to Jesus. So, like, she would be the right person to ask for that intention to pray for us. And bring us closer to him.
I don't know that I've ever heard the Mary is without sin thing. I don't think I've heard that before.
Yeah.
Which is surprising to me.
Yeah. I would also take kind of what Matt was saying, take a step further of just like the idea of like praying to saints and praying to Mary is like not just because of like the relationship on earth, but because of the fact that they're like in heaven.
And wait, so you in heaven, hold on. Like, so you believe the saints are already in heaven? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So from the Catholic Church's perspective, how like they go about like the sanctification is like people who like have lived lives that were one, like very close to God, like within prayer or whatever it was. But then two, like have been deemed to like have like miracles happen based on the intercession of praying for that person. And so, or like, or they were like verifiable miracles that, that happened on earth that like they go through like the very investigative process of that. But basically the belief is that like when you're in heaven, you're okay. in full communion with God, where like, that like we like we can understand this in a way based on like when we receive the Eucharist, but it's still not like the extent to like everlasting as like in infinity it like would work like within heaven, where like it's like outside of time. And so like the belief is that all saints and like Mary who have been canonized within the church like have the belief that they're also that they're in heaven, and then because like heaven's outside, like because like God's outside time, that there are also many other people who are like uncanonized yet by the church that are also in heaven. And so these people would be like the ones that are closest to God. And so like they're the ones that like you can pray for and have like intentional relationships with, knowing that like they're able to mm-hmm. like having an access point to God in such a way that like I can't understand like being on earth basically. But then like also like similar to what Matt was saying, like where you could pray for like your grandfather or something, like there's still like the belief of like purgatory. And so like many people maybe who have not been canonized, verifiably canonized by the church, like are believed to be within purgatory, which at like or had have gone through some level of purgatory. But like the belief is that if like you are in purgatory, like when like the second coming happens, that like everyone then will be like placed into heaven. And like,
so I guess what, so that's interesting. So some people have already been judged and some have not.
Well, because I think technically the end of time, like or like that God being out of time is that like he's already technically judged everyone. Like he already knows like
sure.
like everything's like already happened and like in his omniscience and omnipotence.
But for beings within time.
Yeah, for like for beings within time, it's like the belief that like since heaven is like existing outside of time, that like it's already technically happened. And so we can like pray for them in knowledge of that, but also knowing that technically speaking, I guess like since we're time bound, it like works, I guess, differently in like in that
manner. That's interesting. So are saints outside of time?
Yeah. If they're in heaven, yes, because of like at, like once like you enter into the afterlife, I feel like the afterlife is out of time.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
I don't know. I'm just yeah.
That's how I've come to.
That's interesting. So what? Why? Why would there be a belief that? I guess another difference is like the intercession on behalf of you versus like direct communion with say God or Jesus. Why is that?
Yeah.
Why is there more of an like emphasis on like intercession through a priest or through a saint?
From
I say like, I think it just harkens back to like if like I was in the hospital, like I would ask Tyler to pray for me, I'd ask his parents to pray for me. The power of prayer in numbers is always more than the power of prayer in single number or lower numbers. So it's about asking more people to pray for you, and you're asking those people who probably have a more direct connection to God than your friends or family on earth who are praying for you. So like you think about Saint Raphael, who would be a is like the, I don't know if he's necessarily a patron saint of healing, but like there's a lot of connections he has to health and healing. And so, you know, if you're hot in the hospitalized or sick or something, you might ask him to pray for you because he has that direct connection to God and he is had this connection to healing. Just as you would ask a friend to pray for you, just as you would ask anybody to pray for you, it's very similar, but mm-hmm. sort of on an elevated
level. What about
beyond that? So you still are praying to God and asking Him to heal you, but you're asking for those.
Can I throw in like confession in there as well? Yeah,
sure.
So can you address it from that aspect? Just like the idea of confession. Yeah, like as in, or just like well, I would say like you're, the priest is interceding for you, correct? Yeah.
Through like confession? Not that I know of. Like at least how I understand confession is that like same as like in the mass, like the priest, I guess in a way like intercedes, but like takes the position of like Christ on earth. It's like the physical form, like where like he actually has no power to absolve your sins, but like it's the physical word for like Jesus actually to absolve your sins. So in a way, I guess you could say that's like intercession.
Yeah, it's just I guess it's just interesting because it's like in it's a contrast with like if I'm coming from more of a Protestant background.
Yeah, just like I guess like confession in general, or also like intercession.
Like I mean, from the Protestant background, the belief would be more of a just a direct connection. Like, just, you just pray.
Yeah, you would ask. Yeah.
I think the thing with confession that's, like, really misunderstood sometimes is that it's a, I go and I just say my sins to this priest, and they forgive me. Why can't God forgive me? In that sense, it's sort of like, why do you go to church if you could just pray right at home? It's also this idea of you're going to church to be present in that moment, and to worship God and to receive, for Catholics, the Eucharist in that moment from, as Tyler was saying, someone that's acting as Jesus. And so in confession, the idea is like, you know, you're humbling yourself, like you care enough and you actually are sorry enough about it that you're going to do it. But I think the more beautiful part of it is you're supposed to be receiving healing, in that this person who's acting as God is this most direct form of healing that you can receive for this thing, such that you don't do it again, right? And that's the idea, is that you're going and receiving this healing and having this conversation with this individual about why you're doing these things, how you can overcome them, and then receiving healing for them from this person that's acting as Jesus, versus just, you know, praying to God and saying, you know, I'm sorry, and I want your forgiveness, and you know God forgives you, but you're actually now receiving that forgiveness from an instrument of God who is the priest, and getting healing in the effort to never do it again. And that's why you'll hear like some people go to confession pretty consistently, because the idea is like some people go to confession kind of consistently and then maybe taper off, because if you're struggling with a certain sin, you might want to go every week and be like, you know, to conversation with the priest, I am struggling with this. I still struggled with it again this week. I need this healing. I know it's not right. And you told me this last week. It helped a little bit, but like it's more of a conversation sort of, or it's supposed to be. And so then once they get through with that sin and they're not maybe dealing with it anymore, they might taper off and not go as much. And that's okay. But it's about going through healing of it. And having that instrument of God act through you
For that. I can definitely see it from a human standpoint where you would have more accountability just from actually going and telling somebody, but...
Yeah. I don't know. I think that in a sense of like looking at like intercessory prayer, looking at confession, looking at like, going to like mass or like a church service, like all of it is like for like us, like none of it's for God. And in the sense of like, God's like infinite and like, he doesn't need anything. It's not like, like the Greek gods of like, oh, I need to get like this many tithes and this many like gifts of a cow, and then I'll do what they're asking me, type of thing. Of just like, everything is like for like the sake of like your own like purification of like your heart. And so like when like you're asking for intercessory prayer or you're like, you're going to confession, it's like this contriteness and like acknowledgement of like your own dependence upon like God's salvation in your life, which actually then just like cultivates a greater virtue in your heart to like live like outside of yourself. But I think like it's ultimate like the point of like why like confessions, because like confession isn't given for any other reason than the fact that like, yeah, like the human aspect of like it allows me to like confirm that like I've been like forgiven for these sins, I've been absolved of them, and that like I can move forth in my life without having to wonder if if God actually forgives me, because I can't hear him say he forgives me.
Yeah, I guess the only thing I'd say maybe there's more of an emphasis on like Holy Spirit moving in.
Sure.
That's the only thing I could think where you could maybe say more of a direct connection to the Holy Spirit or something instead of like a representative of Christ. But I don't know. I think with, you know, some reformation, like it's sort of a throw the baby out with the bathwater thing where you do lose some things important, but maybe you made some positive reforms. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's probably always the case. Did you want to talk about the Great Divorce? I know you brought that up when we were talking earlier.
We don't have to talk about it. I think it was just like, it was, I enjoyed it because it was like an interesting rendition on like this idea of just like heaven. And just like in like this like walk of like purgatory, like afterlife, of like basically like C.S. Lewis's interpretation was just like this idea that like hell isn't just like these pitfalls of like fire, and that even like the idea of like purgatory isn't necessarily like this like intrinsic pain. It's just like this idea that like you're just away from God, who is like your creator, who is like your fulfillment of like being a finite being in like with like the infinite, like the infinity and or infinity. And so like within that, it's just like this idea that like there's just like this like loss, like you're unable to ever like fill that. And that's like hell versus, always like on fire. Like this, like artist like rendition of like what hell is. So I just thought that was like really interesting.
Where does that even come from? Does it come from like from Dante, or where does the hellfire, what's that?
It's in the Bible.
Yeah.
Well,
it's in the Bible.
The like final judgment. Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess you're right. It is somewhere. It's in Revelations, right?
Which Revelation is interesting in itself, in the sense of,
yeah,
I say like how everyone reads it tends to be like a apocalypse, basically, that like is like going to ensue upon the earth. But I've been reading this book called The Lamb's Supper, by Dr. Scott Hahn. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. But basically, it's just like he just goes into basically how like this actually, like when like written by John, like even though it appears like a fever dream, it actually just like coincides with the idea of the mass and the sacrifice, and that like a lot of like the extreme imagery that he like paints is actually just to like talk about what actually happens within the mass of like the lamb being God and like all these like different like angels and like the seven-headed the beasts and stuff. But it was like it's like been really interesting so far. I've been about halfway through right now, just because I think everyone kind of like takes Revelations and runs with the fact that it's gonna be like super whack, like end of the world.
Yeah. I know. I've even seen some interpretations where it has already happened or has happened and will recur, and things like that.
Just so weird. Even within the Catholic world, like people are still like kind of like conspiracy based, where like the war between like Russia and Ukraine right now and with like Israel, like is like part of like the eventual like end of the world, where like apparently like Russia and like the uniting of like China and Iran are supposed
to. So that's made it into Catholicism? That's into the top, because like, I think that's like a pretty, it's like a very, I don't know about very, but that's like an American, like millenarian, type of thing that I feel like I don't know. I've seen and kind of been in those communities, and I feel like usually Catholics are like, oh, those are like radical, like evangelicals or something, or that are coming up with like that kind of crazy stuff. But
yeah, it's like weird too, because like it doesn't like nowhere does it explicitly say like in like stuff like, oh, it's like this nation or whatever. But I think like in the what I think from what Father Zach was saying, there's like a some writing about how like a Middle Eastern country and then like a country that's like geographically close to like Russia or China, like all these like different nations, like in their warring cosmology in the world.
Yeah. And it goes back to like what you guys say about symbolism. Like, I think there's always been symbolic, like Easter, like the East is like something and the West is something. And then throughout time, you can always interpret that differently.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we can wrap it up here. Thank you, guys.
Cool. Yeah. Of
course. And you?
Yeah. Thanks for having me. It's been a long time. And
Have you been? Yeah. I don't know how. Have you been like continuing this? Like, I remember like in college, like running through the Coyote Cast, just like watching like all the videos you like, you would make back in Finland. Like, has this been something you've been like continuing?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, much less frequent. And a lot of them, this will probably come out as audio only, I think. So we do have some video stuff that still goes on YouTube, but a lot of it is just audio on, I mean, anywhere. Spotify, Apple. Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you still it's pretty fun. I mean, it's worth it just to sit down and talk with people. I don't really like think about it much after it's like done and posted, but it's pretty cool. Every now and then I get people like text me like, oh, I listened to this one or that one. And even if it's just like a few people, it's pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah. I've been telling a lot of people about the one that I always remember is the one that you had with, with Roman. That one cracked me up. I remember walking like to class one day in Cincinnati, like listening to that story.
Yeah. Oh, like the first one about like, how he said, yeah, he like got contacted by the FBI or something.
Yeah. For like the trying to build a.
Yeah. And I think he was being completely serious. Engine, right? That's the crazy part.
No, I know. Yeah. I believe it.
he's such a smart guy. Very interesting guy. Yeah.
Yeah. But I always loved, like, just the different, like, things. Like, I think about Ethan one time and stuff, where it was always just, like, cool to see, like, just your friends. Like,
yeah, I'd like to keep it going now that everybody's kind of, like, moved to all over the place and doing different things. Mm-hmm. That was kind of the intention of it, was keeping up with people and after high school. And a lot of times you don't ever see sides of people, like in school or something, you talk to them for a little bit. You don't ever get to sit down and talk with them 2 hours, like about a certain topic. No. Yeah.
No. Agreed. No, this is definitely really cool. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on. I'm going to go ahead and stop it here.